The following programming is sponsored by Dr. Joseph Fallon Jr. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
It's time once again to get inside the world of medicine as prominent endocrinologist Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. brings you Inside Medicine. Stay tuned for interviews with eminent medical specialists and receive vital information about your health. Now, here is Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. with another edition of Inside Medicine.
Good morning, South Jersey and Philadelphia. Welcome to Inside Medicine. We're going to have a little bit different spin on today's visit. I'd like to talk a little bit about what trepidations people have to face when the summertime comes. And the first I wanted to talk about is crocodiles and alligators. Not too much of a medical issue, but I do want to say this, that I had the opportunity to see a bunch of crocodiles down in Mississippi and New Orleans, and they are the most impressive fear-mongering animals that I've ever come in case with. But I will have one story to tell you about a cobra. So crocodilians are large lizard-shaped reptiles with four short legs and a long muscular tail. Their hide is rough and scaled. The difference between alligators and crocodiles is often easy to spot once you get the hang of it. Don't get too close. That's my motto. Crocodiles hang out in brackish and saltwater habitats, where other type of crocodilians can hang out in better water, and so that you have two different type of animals here. Now, the thing is that I had a patient years ago who was in Florida, and he went down to one of the water points, and he basically sat at the edge of the water, and a crocodile came up, bit him in the foot, and actually attempted, you know what, to pull him into the water. Now, the question was, this guy was about 225 pounds. He's an individual who helped pave the Jones Fall Expressway and other type of big projects like that. So luckily, he was smart enough, and it is 250 pounds about. He was able to at least pull away, and the alligator crocodile basically took off the front of his foot. So the answer is he was a diabetic. We got him tuned up, came back to the land of Jersey, and everything went well. But the thing about crocodiles and alligators is that if you go down to Disney, you heard years ago that they thought a baby was eaten by a crocodile, yet they never could find. They scanned all the water, euthanized the crocodiles, alligators that were there, and found nothing. So it looks like it was a bit of a stunt. But just remember, crocodiles and alligators, they live about 50 to 60 years. Their highly endangered American crocodile is on the southern tip of Florida. The American alligator is listed as threatened in the American Crocodiles and Dangers. Both species are listed as at risk. The bottom line is that what happens with an alligator or crocodile, they actually pull you into the water, spin you around, i.e. more or less to this basically make sure that you're not really sure where you are. So that's why my patient, who was about 250 pounds, was able to keep pulling back, lost the forefoot of his toe and foot, but basically went back to work and is doing well. So the answer is, please, if you ever go to New Orleans, don't recommend throwing marshmallows into the water, because they do like marshmallows, and it's a little bit on the rough side. So going back to another more positive type of reaction from the Jersey Shore is going to be the jellyfish sting. So the answer is that the jellyfish stings can be painful, itchy, and in extreme cases, deadly. The jellyfish release venom from microscopic stingers on their tentacles called nemesis. Basically, if you are bit by a jellyfish, and I've had that happen to me, and the stings aren't friendly, you're supposed to remove the tentacles, bathe in hot water, apply medication and ice as needed. Some people do experience severe reaction called anaphylaxis to jellyfish stings. Anaphylaxis is a life-threatening risk and needs to be treated aggressively, generally with an epinephrine syringe. And that can do the best thing. But of course, transport to a hospital sometimes is necessary when someone's losing their blood pressure. And basically the immune system is just not doing its thing. So generally you just have to take care of the pain. Jellyfish stings are common. They're mild and readily treatable at home. Jellyfish tentacles have thousands of pneumocysts that can pierce the skin and inject venom. Depending on the species and the venom, the common symptoms are pain, which may be intense and may radiate outward from the site of the sting, red or purplish track marks along the route of contact with the tentacle, local itching and swelling, and rash. The amount of time a jellyfish sting lasts can vary by species. Stings from small blue bottled jellyfish may last 1 hour. A sting from an Australian sea wasp, described by Sun as the most lethal jellyfish in the world, can be deadly, especially to small children. So overall, it's felt to be a sharp, burning, stinging, and tingling sensation on your skin. Often the sting will be accompanied by a throbbing pain radiating upward and outward on an arm, leg, or torso. The sting often leaves tentacle impressions that may be red, brown, or purple tracks. The entire area may be pink, red, or purple. How to treat it? If you're hanging out at the Jersey Shore, Delaware Shore, or New York Shore, rapid treatment of jellyfish stings can reduce pain, keep systemic symptoms from getting worse, and lower the risk of complications. And you have to also be aware of potential infections. There are three steps commonly used. First, you want to rinse that area, rinse away the tentacles using hot water if possible. If hot water is possible, use salt water rather than fresh. Actually, fresh water may worsen the pain. Remove tentacles. Peel off any remaining tentacles with a gloved hand or tweezer. Avoid using bare hands as you risk getting stung again. Take a hot bath. This can help extract some of the venom from the wound. The general rule is to bathe at the hottest possible temperature you can tolerate. Do not be a little bit over crazy. Jellyfish near the eyes. Thoroughly rinse the eye with seawater and then get to the emergency department as soon as possible, as you may need ophthalmologic assessment. Some of the over-the-counter medications you can use after you remove the tentacles, immerse the wound in hot water, and to control pain include over-the-counter medications such as calamine lotion to cool the skin and dry using skin, topical steroids such as hydrocortisone, Tylenol to help out the pain, NSAIDs like Advil or Aleve to reduce pain and swelling, and an ice pack to help things out. Now, if someone is having severe symptoms of an allergic reaction, you got an endocrinologist here and not an allergist. Shortness of breath, wheezing, chest tightness, nausea and vomiting, hives, numbness of the tingling, muscle cramps, blistering skin, difficulty swallowing. These are kind of symptoms that you might want to seek, you know, an ER assessment. Remember, if you become anaphylactic, that's why they have these EpiPens around. And luckily, the EpiPens at one point were incredibly expensive. The price has dropped. So if you're in a jellyfish area, it might be good to have one of those, especially if you have a history of allergic reactions. So remember that if you get severe, then that's an airway problem. It's harder to breathe. Blood vessels start squeezing to push your blood pressure up. And you want to make sure that you wouldn't have a collapse type of thing. Cortisol topically, antihistamines can help. So scraping out stingers, and important, make sure that you're using gloves or in a way that you don't get in contact with the stingers. Rinse with cold, fresh water. Apply meat tenderizer. Apply alcohol. Rubbing the sting with a towel. Applying pressure bandages. So that's all I have to say about what might be happening at the Jersey Shore. We do want to go on to bee stings. So a beekeeper shall locate all hives. This is by the government. All hives a minimum of 10 feet from any property line and at least from 20 feet from any roadside, sidewalk, or path. Bees, wasps, and yellow jackets and hornets definitely can be aggressive at times, especially later on in August to October. There's only 5,000 bee stings a year in the United States, with 50 to 100 deaths in the U.S. Anaphylactic shock where you would need that EpiPen is the remedy. But the bottom line is these things can be tough. Now, what happens if you have a stinger? So the issue with the stinger is that when that gets into the body, you see it sticking out. It pumps. It has a muscle in there, and it keeps pumping the venom in. So the object is not to use your fingers to pull it out. It's actually to flick it with the finger so that the stinger comes out and you're not squeezing the venom in. Very, very, very important. So again, yellow jackets are more aggressive than other type of agents. They tend, especially at certain times of the year towards the end of the season, become much more serious issues. Most people can treat themselves by icing the sting and taking antihistamine. Others may require medical intervention. Just give me a second. So again, yellow jacket stings, its stinger pierces your skin and injects you with venom. Symptoms of yellow jacket stings include sudden, often severe pain that can last for a long time as 2 hours. Remember, a lot of people are just walking in their backyard and they hit, you know, a yellow jacket beehive that's in the ground. Redness and swelling around the site can last for several days. You need to make sure that the stinger is pulled out, but remember, do not pull a stinger out, flick it out. Allergic reactions and anaphylaxis are also possible. So again, anaphylaxis to an insect sting can develop at a rapid pace with symptoms often appearing within 5 to 10 minutes. Delayed reactions are also known and more common with other type of stings. So again, yellow jackets are aggressive, and we need to be very careful. Now, let me just talk about one episode that occurred in my family. My mother, who was actually a very conservative driver and basically always was known to be the slowest gal on the road, my father had a bee sting in the backyard. Basically, he was having symptoms of early anaphylaxis. And so mom put him in the car and apparently went through 2 or 3 red lights to get him to the ER. And we were all proud of her, and she didn't get a ticket. So we're really happy about that, because it would have been a disaster if the police saw her speeding and cutting through lights. And that would have been a good deal. So want to move on. So I do want to talk about certain types of animals. So one thing that came up, I had the opportunity when I worked at the Maryland Poison Information Center to be exposed to an individual who milked venom as a living. He was on to tell the truth, and he had a job of milking snakes for their venom that could be used for medical purposes. So the story was they wanted us who worked at the medical center to be a little bit more adroit at handling certain types of issues. And one was snake bites. So snake bites tend to be very, very interesting. And what they had is they had the individual who milked in Baltimore snakes for their venom for medical purposes, came with a individual from Africa, and they had a number of animals with them that were live. And the first he started out with was red and yellow will hurt a little fellow. And there are certain little snakes that, even though they're small, can be very, very dangerous. So when he opened up a box and brought out one of these little yellow snakes that are called coral snakes, if bitten, they have the ability to generate death. So a little snake, he had him in his hand. Basically, he held them the right way and just demonstrated this little red and yellow snake that could actually cause death. Luckily, they hang out in Florida, and we don't have to worry about them too much. But then he decided to ask for somebody who would come up and assist him in handling one of these snakes. And what happened is, regretfully, I was up front, and he decided to pick me. And he asked me, I'm going to ask you to hold this snake. This is going to be a rattlesnake. And what I don't want you to do is to drop this snake. So this snake probably was about 3 feet, 4 feet. And he said he was going to hold the head and I was going to hold the tail. So anyway, he opens up the box. He uses some kind of wand, and it was a guy from Africa too, and he used another wand, and they lifted him up, and he held the head, and he handed me the tail. So little did I know how strong the snake was going to be. So the snake decides to pee all over me. And of course, the guy keeps saying to me, don't drop the snake, don't drop the snake. And this is a rattlesnake who has the ability to bite and kill. And don't drop the snake. In the meantime, we had about 50% of the people decided to head to the exit because they were a little freaked out. And all he's telling me is don't drop the snake. So anyway, these guys were really sharp. The guy from Africa came over, put one of those wands on him. So they had the rattlesnake basically controlled, put him back in the box. And I thought everything was over. And of course, the snake had done its thing and peed on me. So all I can say is at least I wasn't bit. Lo and behold, was I to find out that there was another snake that was going to come up, and that's a cobra snake. Now, believe me, there are not too many cobra snakes in the United States, so this was a cobra snake that they were milking for venom. And there was associated with this guy his wife. Now, his wife obviously had saved his rear end a few times because he had his own anti-venom medicine in about three ERs in Baltimore because he had been bit before, life-threatening. And so what happened is he had his wife there. And the wife kind of like helped control him and made sure that he didn't try and promote himself or his abilities too much, too often. So what happened is he has this box. There's half of the audience is still there because the rattlesnake chased half out. Lo and behold, he and his partner from Africa, they flip open the box and a cobra snake jumps up. And this cobra snake is about 4 feet high. And the idiot I was right up front, and this cobra is looking at me, and I'm looking at the cobra snake, and all of a sudden there's mass exodus of everybody left in that room out the back door. And it wasn't too well thought out because there was only one exit. And if you want to see people who are smart, who just fall apart, is when a cobra snake looks them in the eye or was looking me. So my initial impression was to turn around and see that everybody was blocking the exit. So it was the cobra snake looking at me, and of course they had two guys, the guy who owned the venom business and the other guy from Africa who I think brought the cobra snake over for milking. Anyway, so I'm looking at the cobra snake, and my answer is, I know that the way they actually get their victims is they actually spray venom in your eye, which blinds your eye, and apparently they're very, very accurate. So luckily, the cobra snake had more than me to look at, and didn't shoot any venom in my eye. But I was frozen there, and said to myself, "It's time to go home." But anyway, the cobra snakes are not in the U.S. They're usually used like in that type of situation for milking for venom. And the one guy from Africa and this other guy who ran his own business basically lassoed it with whatever they had and put the cobra snake back in. And I was very happy, but I do want to tell you, I went home that night with snake pee on me and decided I'm not going to go to one of these lectures again. So that was my story about how to deal with snakes. Now, we also talked about the wasp for my father, and I want to move on to a more subtle type of deal that we usually do here on Inside Medicine. So there's been a lot of progress in weight loss drugs, in GLP-1 drugs, and GIP drugs. So there's been an update on what's going with weight loss drugs, except for the fact that they're very hard to get, and people are getting mad because they can't purchase them because the pharmacies are out. But the new weight loss insights from talking about weight loss drugs. So basically, patients on these medications lose weight, a lot of weight, independent of glucose-lowering properties. So they were originally for diabetics to improve their diabetic control. Things have improved tremendously. So, for instance, as a clinician who specialized in this field for years, it's amazing to see the disease family have a treatment, and that's called diabetes. There was a big change from the previous medications developed for weight loss. If you go back and remember Fen-Phen, which I think was a little bit downtrodden because of inaccurate reporting of heart issues. But by 1997, it was withdrawn from the market, Fen-Phen, which had been highly successful. And basically, there was other drugs that came along, Orlistat, which basically is still on the U.S. market, that basically blocks fat absorption, generating weight loss. There's Q-Simia, which can be effective. That's a combination of fentanyl with Topamax. And there was also Contrate. These are on the market still. They do a good job, but not as potent as the GLP-1 drugs. So again, they were designed to help diabetics, but really what they've done is had people lose a significant amount of weight. And there's also been tremendous findings, as there is less cardiovascular complications when someone is on these medications. And these medications generally were from gut-derived peptides that got put down there. And the FDA recently recognized that there are significant cardiovascular benefits, such as a reduction in systolic blood pressure, the top number, due to a property of the drug, which was explained more so than just weight loss, but by having an efficacious effect on blood vessels. So clinical trials have shown on the 2021 step one trial, participants on semaglutide lost 14.9% of their weight compared to 2.4% in the placebo group. In 2023 step HFPEF, that's talking about heart failure trial, that those on semaglutide lost 13.3% of weight compared to 2.6 in the placebo, but there was a massive improvement in cardiovascular complications. So taking these medications, is that going to decrease your chance of a heart attack? Is that going to increase how long you live? The answer is that yes. And so the FDA recently has approved these medications to help out with patients with heart failure and diabetes. Now, the question is progress going to be held at this point? Absolutely not. Results from Eli Lilly's phase 2 trial with retatrutide, a triple hormone receptor agonist, which blocks GIP, GLP, and glucagon receptor agonists, were published in the New England Journal of Medicine. Those on retatrutide had a weight loss of 30% or more on the highest dose at 48 weeks. The safety and side effect profile was similar to the observed with GLP receptor agonists, but the cardiovascular benefits are improved. Retatrutide appears to be the most potent of the weight loss drugs, and you're going to be seeing a drug on the market that will have the original two, GIP, GLP, and now retatrutide will be on there, generating significant benefit with a reduction in atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. So again, progress is being made. It's just an incredible benefit. So there was a 20% reduction in cardiovascular death, non-fatal myocardial infarcts, or non-fatal stroke with semaglutide compared with the placebo. Now, Eli Lilly and Novo are in this game significantly. And Eli Lilly's phase 3 SURMOUNT-MMO trial, a trial of tirzepatide, is underway and is anticipated that with a new FDA ruling that people who have cardiovascular disease will get access to these GLP-1 type drugs and more. And expect that you're going to have significant decrease in morbidity, mortality. Bariatric surgery should go down. The only problem is how much does this cost and how much is available. Massive insufficiencies of supply is a big issue at this time. Patients kind of like are asking where can they go, and it's just hard to answer everybody's questions because I don't know which pharmacies have drug and which don't. So what about long-term safety? So there is a Dr. Shubhutani, MD, MBA, Managing Director, Global Investment Research, and Senior Pharmaceutical Analyst and Equity Researcher from Goldman Sachs. So the bottom line is that he's basically anticipating that the benefit of these drugs is so great that he anticipates, you know, a progressive increase in other options and a progressive increase in making people live longer and better. So basically his answer is that things have gone so well with GLP receptor agonists that he anticipates no surprises in the future, but of course he's in the business of making sure there are no side effects or bad issues. He indicates that there's going to be more potency coming in the future and more sufficient benefit for society. The question is, as a society, we accept it that these high blood pressure, high cholesterol, heart disease, and diabetes require long-term treatment. As such, it should come to no surprise that those with obesity may also require long-term medication treatment. According to GoodRx, the drug pricing website, the cost of Wegovy is $1,378 a month. However, that can be reduced downward to $550 for Zepbound, which is Eli Lilly's drug for GLP-1 for weight loss and better diabetic control. So actually, we have to say this, that things are really getting better on the diabetic side, and that GLP-1s are getting better all the time. We want to note that they're getting more potent, that the weight loss percentage is going to also improve dramatically. Now, we're going to switch this a little bit to opioid addiction. So opioid addiction is just noted for a significant heart-throbbing losses for families. Let's just say this, that we've seen big political issues where drugs are coming across the southern border near Mexico. And basically, it's incredible how humans can be addicted so easy. So hopefully, politicians will limit how much drug comes across the border so that people will never try it, get hooked on it, and succumb early. So there's a big deal here going that telehealth for combating opioid addiction is part of a recent update, according to the U.S. Department of Health. They want to expand the use of methadone, buprenorphine, and other medications used to treat opioid addiction. This is a first compared to the past 20 years, and hopefully this will decrease addiction. This is, according to the specialist here, represents a historic modernization of opioid treatment plan regulations to help connect more Americans with effective treatment for opioid use disorders. It's going to be especially helpful to people living in rural areas or with low income who may face difficulties getting to the doctor's office. So again, looking for more permanent flexibilities during the COVID-19 taught us that patients can receive take-home doses are more likely to remain treatment and less likely to use illicit drugs. Allowing the use of telehealth to start treatment for opioid addiction, including methadone via audiovisual telehealth technology and buprenorphine, is a significant plus. We do note that it's also going to allow nurse practitioners and physician assistants to order medications for opioid addiction where the state law permits, removing the requirement that patients have a history of addiction for a full year before being eligible for treatment is also on the books. Expanding access to interim treatment, allowing patients to initiate medication treatment while waiting further services to ensure people have access to care as soon as possible. Cementing these policies is a step in the right direction in the fight against the worsening overdose epidemic to increase equitable access to care, reducing stigma of seeking treatment for OUD, and embrace technology in medicine, said Bobby Macamola, MD, one of the members of the Substance Use and Pain Care Task Force. So hopefully this will help families out, because having somebody with a drug addiction certainly is an incredible stress on families. Just want to come up with a quote here. I like George Patton. Accept the challenges so that you may feel the exhilaration of victory. I think that's one thing that can happen now with medications like the GLP. Anybody who gets a significant improvement, such as their thyroid gets retitrated, can be phenomenal. Somebody who gets their GERD treated with excellent medications, just making a better quality of life and hopefully making everybody a bit more productive. Again, accept the challenges so that you feel the exhilaration of victory. Go to the doctor, get the medicines that can help you out, and hopefully they'll be available at the pharmacy. Just want to talk about one other positive, upbeat quote. This is Wayne Gretzky, the Canadian. The highest compliment that you can pay me is to say that I work hard every day and I never give up. And that's an athlete who we like. Now, I want to move on to drug shortages in the United States. So drug shortages in the U.S. have reached an all-time high. Supplies are low for everything from life-saving injections to diabetes medications, according to data from the University of Utah Drug Information Service. They track shortages. They are also note that Ozempic, life-saving allergy treatment, epinephrine, child-friendly forms of the common antibiotic amoxicillin, certain chemotherapies are basically short. We're even having shortages in certain intensive care drugs. According to Utah, a total of 323 drugs were in shortage in the first quarter of 2024, up from a previous high at 320. This is a little bit in 2014. Just states that things aren't being made, progress isn't being made in drug shortages. The American Society of Healthcare System Pharmacists note that the Utah group has been tracking since 2001. Many drugs are generics. What's interesting, you would think that the trade name drugs would be short, like the Ozempics and the Mounjaros and the Zepbounds. The shortages mean that some patients must visit multiple pharmacies to find a drug or wait longer to receive a key treatment, or they get second choice substitutes pay more for generic because the generic drug is not available. A quote was stated, it's like a panic, end quotes, when Stan Brady's pharmacy ran out of Eli Lilly's diabetic drug Mounjaro recently, and he couldn't refill the prescription he had been taking for more than 2 years to control his blood sugar levels. Brady needs to take the diabetic drug to avoid the complications that can result from blood sugar levels that get out of control. It also, remember, these drugs are also showing cardiovascular promise. I just find it amazing that you can't find this stuff and nobody seems to be doing anything about it, states Brady. Lilly said, quote, an unparalleled surge in demand, end quote, for Mounjaro and cousin drug anti-obesity drug Zepbound have limited their availability. The company also has seen supply disruptions for their diabetic drug Trulicity. And I can say this, that in my practice, we have a ton of people on the efficacious Trulicity, and it's just not available. And we're scattering, but there's just these GLP-1s are a significant there's a significant incidence of there's nothing on the marketplace at the pharmacy. So there's a broken supply chain is basically what's being stated. So that Ozempic are running short simply because their makers haven't yet caught up with demand. Health economists have pinned most shortages on a broken pharmaceutical supply chain that makes it difficult for generic drug makers to make a profit and stay in business. I'm actually shocked at this. I didn't know that. The fact is that if you don't have generics available that at a lower price, that people are going to have to upgrade and pay for the brand name drugs. A little bit unfair. Many generic drug makers have left the business or offshored to countries where the labor is cheaper, such as India. I do want to point out that we had carcinogens in our blood pressure pills for one brand of hypertension drugs, and the FDA had to go to India and make a deal for them to make one of these compounds as opposed to all five. So that they, because that hypertensive medicines were not available for so many people. That has since been rectified, but it's just incredible that in my mind, that how come the manufacturers in the U.S. didn't want to make the drug available? I'm sure there's many reasons, but one of those is I just don't think companies like to be pushed around by government. So hopefully that can be smoothed out so that we don't have blood pressure people without medication. And we need to have a deal by the FDA to go not to the U.S., but to go to India to try and rectify a drug shortage. Just to add in, according to the University of Utah, quote, for many of these drugs, there really are one or two suppliers, so you lose capacity there. There isn't additional redundancy, end quote. So we do note that right now, continuing shortages have reached a similar peak in 2014 that had been abated for a number of years. New shortages include rifaximin tablets, which are used to treat diarrhea, meperidine, hydrochloride. Take a look what's happening to the opioid market. We have Tylenol number three, used to treat soldiers in war in World War II, is out. It's hard to find Tylenol number three. Is it going to come back on the U.S. market? What's nice about Tylenol number three is it doesn't generate as much addiction issue risk as the higher drugs, meperidine, and even going up higher, which I don't want to even mention. So again, even we have the lightest pain reliever narcotics, Tylenol number three is not available in pharmacies in the United States of America. I'm sure there's some that have it, but it's basically out. There is a rumor that Tylenol number three will not be back on the U.S. market. What a disaster. Then we're going to have to use more potent narcotics to help people's pain when they can get by with Tylenol number three. So the White House has tried to get involved in this, and they want to put through $3.2 billion over a decade to try and fix these shortages. My impression is that hopefully they'll get things done. Hopefully it get better. And I hope like heck, I don't have to use more aggressive narcotics if someone has pain. And I feel sorry for those guys working in the ER. So just to get a little bit of levity here. How do we make sure that people can, you know, do the best they can? And one of the recommendations has been that if you add exercise to someone's regimen, that basically they can improve. So there was a little bit tongue-in-cheek here in the Wall Street Journal, apparently today or yesterday. So here it is. A revolutionary Mayo Clinic study has determined that active workstations consisted of a walking pad, bike, stepper, and or standing desk are successful at improving mental cognition in the workplace without in any way reducing job performance. According to the study recently published in the Journal of American Heart Association, it's not just a question of keeping employees healthy by getting them to exercise more often. Mild physical activity, such as walking up and down on a stepper while we are working, actually helps us to think. So get that. If you're on a stepper, it makes you think better. I like it. So the question here is that what did the Wall Street Journal and Joe Queenan come up with? Anybody who doubts the negative effect of protracted sitting on the overall brain function need look no further than United States House of Representatives. Glad I didn't write the article. Trapped in their comfy armchairs, these inert layabouts go months and months without getting anything done or saying anything intelligent. And a lot of them are woefully out of shape. Remember, this isn't me. But if the Mayo Clinic study is on the money, exercise makes you think better, and thinking better makes you legislate better, everybody knows that. So install 435 exercise bikes, steppers, and walker pads on the floor of the house and get these guys and gals using the old noggin again. The sight of the nation's representative getting off their duffs and actually doing something would be inspiring. Of course, this is not Joe Fallon. I just had to bring this up, what I saw in the news. Now, the only other item that I want to talk about basically is go back on the GLP-1 drugs. So what we're seeing here is that these hormones that basically are in our gut have been modified and adjusted. And I have to give pharma credit. They've done incredible things, and every time you turn around, they're getting better. So we've had some specialists on GLP-1 drugs in the past. If you look at our website, they're available. Just to get more education, you can see the progress is being made. So instead of having one drug there was two drugs, and now they have three drugs that they're going to add in that's not on the market yet, but which should do, you know, increased help. Increased help and metabolic improvement, will that make people live longer? Yes. Will that make people more productive? Yes. Will that decrease MI and stroke? That's why you saw the U.S. government, FDA, point out that the GLP-1 drugs can decrease cardiovascular events. That's opened up a whole possibility of more drug use for people who have overweight, who have heart disease, who don't know they have heart disease, and who want to use these drugs to generate the weight that they were when they were in high school. That would be fantastic. So good things are happening. Now, the issue is that there's been some new pushes to try and get things better for make sure doctors are more efficient. And there's a statement out here that when doctors don't talk to each other in medical economics recently, and it's very, very interesting as a practicing physician, you know, how things have changed. But everybody has to make a commitment to trying to work together, get things done, get the information out. The only problem is that if you have information excess, it's kind of hard to make sure that everybody's getting a fair shake. And it's just tough. So the next thing I want to talk about is going back to one of my favorites is hypertension, because this week we've had some issues. There is a resistance to someone getting on another blood pressure pill. So it kind of drives me crazy because the data is that if you take three blood pressure pills, it's safer than taking two blood pressure pills. And the whole deal is that when you treat hypertension, the goal is to get someone's blood pressure into the normal range. And when you tell somebody you're going to start with one and then you add two and then you add three, it's kind of like, hey, is my price going up? But really what's happening is you're limiting the side effects of the drug. So hypertension has been incredibly successfully treated. And the problem is you don't want to get too excited that you're going to be on three drugs, because basically three drugs is better than one drug a lot, and that the combination of the three basically gives you better results, smoother results, and less complications. So again, on the hypertension front, please make sure that it's understandable that you will definitely do better at times with three drugs because the side effect profile goes down and the efficacy profile goes up. So incredibly happy about that. Now, another item that's come up is renal function in diabetics. And we've seen a massive improvement in renal function for diabetics these days. And generally, there's three types of drugs that are used for this. But it's just phenomenal to see how technology has moved up. So we have people who are taking diuretics, usually well-tolerated. Sometimes people have to be titrated on which diuretic. We have diuretics that last a few hours. We have diuretics that last 16 hours. And if you pick the right diabetic, then people get up in the morning, they don't have any fluid in their legs. When they come home at night, they don't have any fluid. So diuretics, very inexpensive. And they do a great job. Some people want a 6-hour diuretic. Some people want an 18-hour diuretic. But the offerings are great, and the intervention is highly successful. So most people who have hypertension will end up with a diuretic, especially if they have any pitting edema down by their ankles. You can put your little finger in over the tip of the tibia. And if you have denting, you know, and it's on both sides, it's a reasonable reason to think that the doctor will give you a diuretic. Then we have other medications, ACEs and ARBs. So ACEs have been around a very, very long time, over 30 years. And I remember when the first ACE was approved, it was Altace, and that was approved by the FDA. And it turned out that the day before that drug was published on its efficacy in the New England Journal of Medicine, a group of pharmacist in Washington, D.C. area bought the rights to the drug, and they didn't know the results of the test. Then it was done and published the next day in the New England Journal of Medicine. That drug was Altace, That drug has ramipril. That drug has been on the market a long time, highly efficacious, side effect profile minimal. But it was interesting to see that these three pharmacists, all brothers in the D.C. area, had the guts to, you know, invest in that particular drug. And ramipril became a seller and still on the market and is helping a number of people. One thing about ramipril is that you get better kidney function, better blood pressure control, so that they, therefore you're protecting your heart and blood vessels. So a very interesting, I happen to know one of the brothers who bought that drug, and congratulations to them. So that was an ACE inhibitor. Now, the only side effect, the problem with ACEs is some people can develop a cough, and the cough is certainly not well tolerated. And then you can go to a different branch of that, which is a non-ACE drug, and you see Avapro is one of the drugs that they use in that case. So if somebody has a cough from the ACE, they can go over to the Avapro type drugs and do wonderful. You got to remember when the ARB type of business flared up a few years ago, that the FDA requested that the company in India just make one of the ARB drugs and bring them to the U.S. when there was a significant shortage of that drug category. And then finally, so then we have also Kerendia. Now, Kerendia is a blocker, and it's just turning around kidney disease, turning around heart attacks, just doing a phenomenal job. That drug is used, can be first line, could be second line, but basically it's a 10 milligram drug. If your kidney function is good, a lot of times they'll put it up to a 20. But we've seen massive turnarounds in kidney function with a combination of ACEs, ARBs, and also Kerendia, which is an aldosterone blocker, incredibly beneficial. Most people who get these drugs basically do a urine test. They try and see how much albumin is leaking out of your kidney. So it turns out that if you're, the numbers are, if it's less than 30, you're a star and in great shape. If you're 30 to 300, you probably want to get some aggressive intervention to prevent this in reverse. And if you're over 300, you know, then it's going to be a full tilt. Usually the doctor will give you a nephrologist, and they'll use ACEs, ARBs, water pills, and of course, Kerendia is the only one on the market that does this wonderful reversal. You can see people's kidney function improve dramatically. One of the things to remember, though, is that drug doesn't only just improve kidney function. It also has positive cardiovascular benefits. With the use of that drug, there's a significant reduction in MI, stroke, and death. So Kerendia is an incredibly positive drug. You definitely have to make sure your doctor puts the right code on so that the insurance company knows it's for a renal protein leak. And if that occurs, then what happens is this drug will make significant gains. I've been so impressed with the efficacy of that drug. So again, we've got some of the best events occur. Renal function has improved dramatically. So the issue here is how do we make sure that patients get medications? And of course, we have certain drugs that cost a lot more money. We also saw that this drug shortage is an issue. So the kind of goal here is how can we make sure that people, you know, get to the doctor, get their medications, and then hopefully somebody can do something about the pre-certification process where we basically see a significant paperwork challenge for physicians to try and get people their medication. And if you have 20 pre-certs in a day, it's kind of hard to keep up. So if you're using the cutting edge drugs, they want to push you the other way. That's the people paying for the medication, which makes it tough. But my overall feeling is that medicine is getting better and better. Patient care is getting better and better. So I'm really, really happy about that. Now, the only other item to talk about today is going to be diabetic drugs. So again, we have this problem when people come into the office and they say, look, I'm not that sick, so I only get one drug. So there's something called Synergy. And that's why when you have a physician taking a look, or a nurse practitioner taking a look at somebody, say diabetes, there's many, many drugs to treat diabetes now. And the answer is, we have to take a look at someone's pocketbook. We have to take a look at what their insurance company will permit. But the key is that taking three drugs for diabetes can be incredibly better than taking one drug for diabetes. So if someone wants us to just push the drug all the way up, the side effect profile generally goes up. So usually there's a cut point where you want the best results with the least side effect. So again, I try and tell people with blood pressure, the average person takes three blood pressure pills. In diabetes, that can be the case also. If somebody's got early diabetes, we can use a sulfa drug. But generally, most people start with metformin. So metformin's been on the market years and years. And if you go back to that, the American Diabetes Association went to the FDA and said, look, England's got this metformin drug. It's doing phenomenal results. It turns out the people who take that tend to live longer. Side effects are usually minimal. Yes, you can get diarrhea, but overall, the people who get it can do incredibly well. It also increases the oxygenation of your brain cells by 3,000-fold, which has never been proven, but it certainly sounds like it should have significant benefit. So a lot of people are started off with either a sulfa drug or with metformin. Results are phenomenal. And then if one doesn't work, a lot of times we add a second in. You're using a different mechanism of action. Just like the hypertension deal, you use one medication, different one, and then you get two. Now, what happens if you need to go to three? Well, in diabetes, that usually occurs, especially because we can always give somebody insulin, but insulin tends to put weight on people. Most of the people do not like it, especially those with X chromosomes. And it's kind of, you have to kind of negotiate with the patient how to play it. But don't be surprised if you're using three drugs when you were hoping just to use one. Three drugs doesn't mean that you're sicker. It just means that your doctor is trying to minimize side effects and maximize gain. So we have the metformins. We've got the sulfa drugs. Glimpiride is well known. There's some drugs that just last 2 or 3 hours because people just need it before the meal. Prandin's one of those. Then we go up to pioglitazone. So pioglitazone has a phenomenal efficacy. The side effect is people can gain some fluid. So if you don't like fluid, maybe it's not for you, but basically not everybody gets fluid, and you can also use a low-dose diuretic. But pioglitazone basically takes fat out of your belly and puts it on your hips. So when you take fat out of the belly, you become less diabetic. And Actos has proven to be on the market a long time, great results. Yes, you have to watch out that it can gain weight, because if you become a more efficient machine and you're eating the same calories, your brain has to recalculate how much you need to eat. So one of the side effects of pioglitazone is that if you take it for 10 years, you live longer. I call that a side effect. Fantastic. But you can also gain weight. But it's a phenomenal drug, especially if somebody's got a drug bill that's extensive, because this is a drug that's been on the market. It's been proven. And it's inexpensive. So we've got glucophage, we've got sulfa drugs like glimpiride, we've got medications such as pioglitazone, and then you have the newer ones, the ones that are Farxiga and Jardiance. These drugs basically protect your kidney, protect you from heart disease. They're doing many, many things to make sure you're in good shape. They're once-a-day drugs. The only problem is they're off patent. They're on patent, and they can cost a little bit more. And hopefully your insurer will cut down the price to make it possible that you can use these drugs. So fantastic. So you have the SGLT2s, and we're talking about the classic one. There's Steglatro, there's the Jardiance, and we have the Farxigas. So and Invokana, excuse me. So then we have moving up. You can use other medications, such as the GLP-1s, and that's what everybody likes, because GLP-1s, the great side effect is that people don't eat as much, they lose weight. Take a look at Oprah Winfrey, and take a look at a few of the other gals out there who are in the spotlight, how much weight they can lose. So the GLP-1s, generally, Victoza was the first one out. It's going to be taken off the market at the end of this year. which is a shame. Great drug. The only problem is you had to inject that every day, generally twice. And now we have the longer drugs, the Ozempics and the Mounjaros, which basically are injected once a week. You want to basically just get a four pen RX. You don't want to go to your long acting pharmacy because then you're going to stay at that dose for 12 weeks. It's better to kind of go to the local pharmacy. Will they have it? ? And then basically you take your shot once a week. The doctor will see how well it's responding. You will see how well you're responding. You'll notice that you're not going to eat as much. You're going to notice that it's easier to control your sugar. And, of course, the FDA has just stated, I think 2 weeks ago, that it has proved that you'll live longer. My overall impression is, thank you for listening. Joe Fallon signing out. Catch everybody next week. We will have a guest again. Thank you, Dr. Fallon.